A phrase we've been using is the phone is a platform, but then you need the pedagogy.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Across the world, mobile phones are no longer just for keeping in touch. We use them when we want to send or receive money. We use them when we travel or for entertainment. But given that almost every household everywhere has at least a simple mobile phone, are we taking advantage of its potential for education in developing countries? A new J-PAL Policy Insight reviews 30 studies of mobile phone education programs designed to improve student learning or teacher behavior or parental engagement. Jenny Aker of Cornell and Noam Angrist of the University of Oxford are the academic leads on that study. Both of them join me now. Hello, Jenny.
Hi, Tim.
And hello, Noam.
Hello.
I did say that almost everybody has a phone almost everywhere. Am I right? How pervasive are phones in low middle income countries? What sort of phones are we talking about?
Yeah, you're almost right. I mean, over the course of the past three decades, we've really seen this huge ICT boom. If you look at mobile phone coverage, it's really expanded rapidly worldwide. There were almost non-existent networks at the turn of the century. And now figures estimate that about 95% of the world's population at least is covered by a broadband network. More households in low-income countries own a mobile phone than have access to electricity or clean water. If you look at sub-Saharan Africa, about 80% of the population has mobile phone coverage, and about 60% of the population has adopted it. So they have a handset or access to a handset in some way. What people are primarily adopting is really these simple mobile phones. So mobile phones that you or I might have used about 15, 20 years ago, which was a Nokia, kind of a simple handset. Smartphones are becoming more prevalent, but that is primarily in some wealthier countries, among more urban populations, and in particular areas of low and middle income countries.
We've often covered programs for which the phone's been a delivery mechanism or it's been used for data collection. It's something that we're talking about more and more. What sort of programs here have been successful?
Even though we look at the phone in all of its complexity, you started off talking a little bit about the fact that the mobile phone is really just this communication device. You can send and receive information more cheaply across these very long distances. And that can be text, it can be voice, it can also be emails, it can be searching for information. About 15 years ago, it went from being a simple communication device to a financial service device with mobile money, which then allowed people to send and receive money transfers even without having a bank account. So there's a lot of literature that really looks at these two functionalities of the mobile phone as a communication device and as a financial service device and how that affects people's lives. And it's actually quite effective, right? It makes markets happen more efficiently, especially grain markets. It allows people to get better access to transfers, especially when they have a shock, and smooth that consumption in the face of shocks. Today, we're going to be talking a lot about education. And when we look at the ways in which the mobile phones can be used in education, both for children and for adults, it's going to span these two uses that I've just talked about, but in very different and in nuanced ways.
Education has a lot of problems at the moment. What are the big problems that it might be applied to that it could help to solve?
So I think that there's several different ways that we can use mobile phones to overcome some of these difficulties. I mean, the first one is really access. You know, if you think about whether there are primary schools and the fact that primary schools have really increased, distance and poverty remain extremely important. And if a school is closed or a school doesn't exist, then there is the potential maybe for using a mobile phone in a way to reaching out to those populations. The second one is potentially staffing or capacity of staff. Now, we know that teachers might be posted in very remote rural areas, and it's difficult for their supervisors to get contact with them, or it might be difficult to train them. And so using mobile phones as a way to provide pedagogical support or potentially to monitor or to motivate them can be things that can potentially be quite effective, but there can also be some drawbacks. The third one is that can really be used as an input. We often think of schools and chalkboards and things like that. But you can think about the mobile phone might allow you to learn while you're sitting in the classroom, but also as you leave the classroom and you're at home, which might allow you to continue to learn even when you're not sitting in a physical space. And then the final one is we know that in some cases it can be difficult to get access to salaries, especially for teachers in remote rural areas. And if there's a delay and it can take some time, then potentially there's the opportunity to use that same mobile phone as a way to pay for those salaries.
Last week, we were talking about the high hopes, if you remember this, for one laptop per child. That's a very ambitious technology program, which was doomed to failure because it was the wrong technology. What is it about phone technology that might make it useful in these situations if we can get the services that are delivered through it, if we can get that right?
The one laptop per child was a lot of hype and was eventually a failure. So that's an important cautionary tale. Mm-hmm. One of the big differences with phones is this is a platform that's already something that households are using, you know, parents are using, teachers are using, students are using. And so it's not like you're providing a new gadget. And that's where a lot of efforts like One Laptop Per Child have failed, is they're trying to introduce a new way of communicating and trying to do that very rapidly without enough support, without enough piloting, testing, making sure that that's successful, or thinking about the other enabling conditions, like can you charge the laptop? Does it have the right software, not just the right hardware? So what's remarkable about phones is they're this platform that's available, low cost, and in use. So the marginal cost of adding good pedagogy or good support is actually pretty low. As long as that is beneficial, you get really high returns.
So in your review of what has worked, my first thought would be, let's use phones like all the messages I get on my phone. Send mass messages with instructions for kids who can't get to school. Maybe we could send videos to them to help them with their homework. I imagine this has been tried. How well has it worked?
One of the findings that we put forward in this piece is the importance of interactive exchange through the phone. And so more one-way style messaging has had a harder time succeeding. Uh-huh. And so things that have this dual exchange are often more effective. It's very tempting to just blast out SMS messages that's really cheap and really scalable, but some type of more interactive two-way exchange component seems to be really important. Another thing that we find is really important, and there's still some emerging research on this, and so it's not yet totally conclusive, but are these interventions effective as a substitute or as a complement to what's going on? Some of the evidence suggests that it's probably more effective at the moment as a complement when you're kind of building on something, whether that's parents who are already engaged or instruction that's already happening. That seems to be where there's really high returns. Though there is some emerging evidence that it can also be effective as a substitute. But only relying it on a substitute, that remains something where there's conditions where that works and conditions where that doesn't work.
If you have to have an exchange for this to work well, you have to have someone at each end of this at the same time, both taking part in it. If you have a tutor and a child both available and communicating, sounds great, but I would imagine it would raise the cost and lower the scalability of any kind of intervention.
One of the big challenges for tutoring through phone is scheduling, actually. So one thing that we find is once you can get on the phone and get into instruction, it's incredibly effective. But it is true that scheduling is not straightforward. And about half the time is actually spent scheduling as instructing in some of the research that we've done. Making that easier is a really important thing. That said, even with that challenge, phone call tutoring is incredibly cost effective. When you actually look at the cost per child and the effectiveness, I think we get about 4 high quality years of schooling per $100. And if you look at the review of the evidence over 150 different studies, that's in the top 10. So even with that scheduling friction, these are very cost-effective interventions, but you can make them even more cost-effective by reducing that scheduling friction. And there's some ongoing research to try to look at that. So for example, we did some randomized A-B tests in Botswana trying to address that exact constraint. And so one way that we did it was a bit subtle, but really useful, is instead of doing one call a week for 20 minutes, we did one call a week every other week for 40 minutes. So it's actually the same total dosage, but now you don't have to call as often, so you're scheduling less often. And so you're changing that ratio of scheduling to instruction, and that worked just as well, but was lower cost and more efficient. There's lots of margins you can use to keep optimizing that, but already it's quite cost effective.
You started it off by talking a little bit about mass messaging, right? So we think that it's simple, it's easy. I press a button, I remind you, or I send you a message, and it's done. But using the technology facilitates these things, makes it lower cost, easier reach. But that doesn't replace the need to really think about how people learn, how parents engage, how teachers engage. So a simple thing about how often you might call people or how often you might send a message. If you send me 20 messages, then I start checking out. But then thinking about that in a thoughtful way and doing some testing about really where is the sweet spot to do this can be really important with all of these types of technologies.
You did mention, Noam, that this has been more effective as a complementary technology. Sometimes it can't be complementary. Kids can't get to school. There might be a conflict situation. Climate change has created problems where often people can't get to school. Is there potential here, do you feel, for at least temporarily, phone delivery of education to replace schooling?
So COVID was this moment where there was a flurry of innovation and research on exactly those kind of questions. And so now we have a lot more evidence than we did a few years ago. And during COVID, indeed, it was effective in a bunch of settings, these types of interventions as a substitute, which has now provided some new evidence on what that can look like. And of course, COVID was a historic shock. Schools were disrupted en masse. But indeed, schools are disrupted very often, actually, beyond COVID. Climate shocks, floods, typhoons, heat, conflict. And the United Nations actually has a global fund called Education Cannot Wait, which is dedicated to trying to address and provide education during these disruptions, but actually has very little evidence to go on. Now, some of these studies during COVID have really informed these global structures that provide education in emergencies. And it does look like there's some new evidence suggesting it actually can also work as a substitute. The lighter interventions like SMS messages don't work as well as a substitute. They do seem to work better as a complement. But the live instruction through tutoring or things of that nature, teacher coaching, they seem to be able to work as a substitute.
Also, if you think about adults, about 1 billion adults worldwide cannot read and write in any language. Yeah. Adult literacy is very popular, but there's a lot of literature that shows that people don't sign up, or when they sign up, they drop out. And there are many areas where there are also conflict settings, or adults might be quite busy because it's the agricultural season. And this type of technology as a substitute has the potential. And there's some kind of this emerging research, as Noam has mentioned, that we had worked on in Niger by building out a whole curriculum in Hausa via the mobile phone, testing whether or not this substitute could actually be quite effective, at least in getting people to be able to decode letters and syllables and words.
Now, a slightly different application. I know that in some cases, phones have been used to check teacher attendance at school because we hope to improve that. What's the problem here? How well has that worked?
Well, I think the challenge or the motivation for this has been that if you look across in many low-income countries that kind of teacher attendance rates, they can be quite spotty or quite low. And that is often due to the fact that, you know, teachers might be in very remote rural areas. It's difficult for the government to get in touch with them, to go out and visit them, to potentially have the budget to train them. And in that case, the question is, how do you follow up? So mobile phones have been used either for calling or for texting those teachers or school directors or parents to see whether or not they were actually in school and kind of what type of job they were doing. The evidence here is, though, mixed. In some cases, some work that we have done actually showed that it was quite effective in motivating teachers and bringing to the top of mind their job. They showed up more and they taught better and students learned more. In some other work in Ivory Coast, it found that there was this demotivating factor that teachers felt a little bit that they were being too much monitored, right? And they were receiving too many messages. So it gets again to this sweet spot. Who is being engaged and are people being similarly rewarded and motivated at the same time that they might feel that they're being monitored?
Yeah, that has been a problem in North America and Europe as well. Workplace monitoring, how it's done really makes a huge difference between people feeling that they're being cared for or spied on.
Yes. And we definitely found that. We found two things where teachers said, I feel that really my work is important here. And others said, okay, now I know that my work is potentially being controlled.
Another challenge that we've discussed on VoxDev Talks before is when we have improved curriculums or changed the way in which teaching is delivered, that often it's very difficult to help teachers learn these new methods or give them the materials they need. Can this type of technology help them?
I think it's a really interesting application of mobile phones, and it's related to some of the benefits that Jenny was referring to earlier, as it's a very low-cost way of reaching people. It's a low-cost, high-access platform, including teachers. So absolutely, I think it has a very viable use case to essentially provide teacher coaching. The evidence on teacher coaching is reasonably clear that it's quite effective and often more effective than teacher training, actually. So one of the insights from some of the evidence on teacher training is that a lot of teacher trainings actually don't work very well, general skills teacher training, and you do actually need these ongoing coaching interventions. The challenge for the coaching interventions is they're quite expensive when they're in person. The phone call coaching or mobile phone enabled coaching could be a very cost-effective enhancement that makes this sustainable and scalable. So there's now some exciting research on that issue. And that research is still emerging, but it seems to be a really promising area to take this known class of interventions of teacher coaching and make them more affordable and sustainable.
Can phones help to involve parents in their children's education?
Phones can be useful in helping parents engage in their students' learning. It can allow them to get information either via text or via call about whether or not their students are attending school or how they're doing in school. It can also allow those parents to call in themselves to potentially ask questions, or if there potentially are issues with the teacher themselves, to kind of provide a little bit of feedback. Now, what that does require is at the other end to have someone to take that feedback and potentially do something with it. And some of the work that's been done in a few countries has really shown that kind of it is a way to get parents more engaged and at least more aware of how things are going in the school. How do you translate that awareness into actual engagement and learning?
There's this perception that in many low-income settings, parents can't be that effective in education, often because they're fairly low literacy and there's been huge changes in literacy rates across generations. Parents or grandparents often have less education than their children. And so they sometimes themselves don't see themselves as conduits for education. They say the teachers have you covered, the schools have you covered. What role do the parents play? Are they able to, even when they have fairly low literacy, support education? The evidence is showing that they can play a role. And that is an enormous resource because children spend a lot of time at home with their parents. Trying to engage parents in low-income settings and middle-income settings is a very low-cost and high-return way to build human capital. And so these phones are a key way of doing that. You're calling into the household, you're supporting into the household, the phone is mediated by the parent often. And so that seems to be really promising. One randomized A-B test we did was exactly targeting this margin, where halfway through a tutoring call, the parent was asked to take over. And the parents did in about half of cases, so not all cases. When that happened, the treatment effects doubled to tripled. There's other evidence on engaging parents as well that's very promising.
So if I'm the policymaker, the practitioner, and I'm getting a sense of the possibilities of this, I would be sure to ask the two of you about it. You've read all the research and you've done quite a lot of it. What would you tell me about the lessons that stand out from the body of research that we have now?
I think I might start off with three very broad lessons. And the first one is what Noam had talked about in the beginning, is that if you start off with a technology that already exists and that many people are already using and know how to use and can charge and get access to, there's a higher chance of success, right? So if you're bringing in something that's new or needs to be charged or needs to be distributed, that can make it quite difficult for it to be sustained and persist. The second one is, despite the fact that there are some exceptions where this technology can be an important substitute in conflict areas or such as the like, you know, in many cases, it really is an important complement to what is already happening either in the classroom or within the community. And the third part is that because it's a complement, thinking through some of these very important elements of pedagogy, how students learn, how teachers teach, how the community gets involved, are extremely important. And those are things that while they can be tested, and expanded and scaled across different countries, you still need to kind of do a little bit of the hard work at the beginning to think through, you know, how often should we be calling? Should the parents actually be engaged in order for these things to be effective for a given context?
A phrase we've been using is the phone is a platform, but then you need the pedagogy. So platform and pedagogy. There's other types of pedagogy that you can integrate into the phone platform. Targeting instruction, early childhood stimulation with parents is another piece of pedagogy that can be integrated through the phone. So the phone is a platform. It's not a pedagogy itself. So very much agree with the 3 points Jenny said, and I just wanted to emphasize that last one. For the policymakers who also care about research as well as policy, phones also offer an opportunity to learn a lot because there's a lot of data flowing through that interaction in a way that's very traceable, privacy considerations being considered, but you can get a lot of access to data and information. The units of randomization that you can deploy through the phone are also really statistically powered. It's a platform both for intervention, but it's also a platform for learning, really rich learning.
But no, am I being too negative if I was to summarize this as the things that scale easily don't really have a big impact, and the things that have a big impact, well, they're difficult to scale?
I don't believe that, actually. There's a phrase that John List has used called voltage drop, right? That kind of the things that worked initially in small controlled settings start to work less well over time as you scale. And that is a phenomenon that might be true. I think that is the case. Is it inevitable? I think that's the question. I don't think it's inevitable. And so one example of this, just from some research that we did, is the initial kind of phone tutoring study we did in Botswana, that had a 0.12 standard deviation impact. Then we replicated that in 5 additional countries, and the effects kept going up and up actually in sequence of the order of the study. So we did 5 additional RCTs, and by the time we got to the last country, Uganda, the treatment effect was over 0.8 standard deviation. And so one thing that we think was happening there is that we learned from experience. And so actually, it was different implementers. It wasn't the same implementer. You know, there was some of the implementers were big and bureaucratic, like the World Bank or governments in a few of the countries. So it's not that the implementers were systematically more nimble or kind of stronger implementers. It was that there was learning from experience. And if you actually look at implementation fidelity data, you indeed see that implementation fidelity improved in tandem with the order of the study and with the learning effect. So that suggests that you can have this learning curve and you can scale and improve impact, not just reduce impact as you get bigger, as you grow. And there's other evidence on this phenomenon that's emerging. So yes, the typical situation is a sad situation where something worked and then it stops working. That's definitely the most common. But there are techniques that you can use to learn from experience. There are examples of things that can scale and improve their impacts over time.
And I would just add one thing, which is it isn't necessarily that it's always it worked in one context and then didn't work. It just might be it still was effective, but the magnitude of that impact was a little bit smaller. And if you compare that with the actual costs of providing it via a mobile phone and the counterfactual, which is the status quo or doing nothing, then it can actually end up being very cost effective. So focusing on what the magnitude of the treatment effect is important, but also then compared with the costs and compared with what the status quo might be is very important.
Considering the challenges that we're facing, conflict, climate, capacity demands, how important is it that we get this right?
I have been stunned by how little evidence there is in emergency settings and also how common they are. And I must admit, I was not aware how common they were till COVID. That kind of got me thinking more about, is this a pervasive issue, the disruption? And then we started building a database of school disruptions and we saw it was very, very common. And we saw that there were all these humanitarian structures around that disruption, but very little evidence. Actually, some of Jenny's evidence was some of the only evidence on using mobile phones in education till COVID.
Given the sheer magnitude of what we're seeing in terms of displaced populations, children and adults alike, and some of those displaced populations might not be there just temporarily, they're there for years. Education can be crucial in really understanding what works and how it works and why it works. Like some of the evidence that NOME has been generating in this area is really helping us to learn what could be done in some of these contexts.
Now we actually have a menu of things that are more viable to scale and have impact. Education Cannot Wait estimates that 222 million children experience some form of school disruption annually. So it's a really big problem. And now we're starting to have some possible solutions. So it's a moment where I think there's really an imperative to take advantage of this evidence and put it into action.
Well, thank you both of you for the work that you've done, for taking time to talk about it today.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
If you want to read the policy insight, it's called Leveraging Mobile Phones for Learning. Authors, Jenny Aker and Noam Angrist. You heard from the two of them today. Also credit to Jessica Williams and Demetria Wack. It is a JPL Policy Insight, published 2026. We'll put a link to it in the show notes, as always. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. There's a new episode every Wednesday, so follow the show wherever you get your podcasts, and you'll never miss one. Our past episodes are at voxdev.org, and we have articles on the topics we cover there as well, and we link to those in the show notes too. If you like what you hear, tell someone about us and leave us a review as well. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.